So last time we spoke about the getting the four captives and the beginning of real Torah learning in Torah centers outside of Bavel, outside of Babylonia, Iraq. We spoke about the Dakhtakin. Now we're going on to the beginning of the Mishana.
Can I ask you just a quick question?
Yeah.
What about the Khuzars? What's the deal with
The Khuzars.
When is that supposed to happen?
When did the story of the Khuzars happen?
Is that legitimate?
Well, Yehuda HaLevi, is it a legitimate story?
Yeah.
Or is it fictional? Or is it Ki'ilu Jewish historical fiction? So, 300 years ago, people weren't sure about it. But now that we're in touch, that's not archaeological. I'm not sure if there are archaeological, proof. But there is historically accepted today that the Khuzars, there were people called the Khuzars. Most people believe that those are what are known today as Gruzinim, Georgian Jews, are largely descended from the Khuzars. Of course, the Sefer HaKhuzari is written by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, it's his own work. No one's, it's like inspired by the fact that there was somebody who convinced the king of the Khuzars to convert and was able to, satisfactorily answer all his questions. It took place around the year 800. Around the year, in the time of Gaonim, but it was way at the peripheral. It was in the, it's Trans-Caucasus, Trans-Caucasian Mountains. The Caucasian Mountains separate Asia from Europe, and it's in the Asian side as opposed to, it's in the European side as opposed to being in the Asian side. So in terms of, I got from Rafi. Yes, Shkai. So that's when that story happened. Okay, now we're going to go on to Rabbeinu Hananel. Rabbeinu Hananel is known, he's quoted as Tosus in the Rishonim as the Rach. He was the son of Rabbeinu Hushiel. Hushiel was one of the four captives. He's the one who ended up in Kairouan in Tunisia. He wrote, I'm not sure if it's the first Perush on Shas, but let's put it this way. It's the first Perush which has lived and stood the test of time on Shas. Since I don't know how much you guys are familiar with Rabbeinu Hananel, it's sort of like it's a parish on Shas. Yes, it's a parish on Shas. It's not quite. It's similar to Rashi, sort of, but it's hard really to say. The way it looks like to me, we're talking about Rabbeinu Hananel. The way it looks like to me is Rabbeinu Hananel. He synopsizes the Gemara. I wouldn't say quite like the Rif, but like a step towards the Rif. And in the middle, he will throw in his own comments, Perushim and comments.
So it's in between Rashi and Rif.
That's right. The feeling I have gotten personally from learning Rabbeinu Hananel is that Rabbeinu Hananel is, again, halfway between a Posek and a Mefarish. That's just a feeling I got. I'm not yet, I didn't find anyone who agrees with me. That's just like the feeling that I get. One of the key differences between Rabbeinu Hananel and Rashi is Rashi, he doesn't comment quite as much on the Gadata as he does on Halachic Sugyas. Rashi does comment on the Gadata Sugyas. Rabbeinu Hananel, I wouldn't say never comments on a Gadata, because that's not true. But he usually doesn't comment on a Gadata. What? Stories, Midrash, stories brought in Shas. Rashi does comment less on a nagana that he does on a halachic piece of Gemara. But the facts are, it's inaccurate to say that Rabbeinu Hanan doesn't. Rather, he comments much less. And again, somewhere, because as I said, it's like somewhere between a Mefarsh and a Posek, Rabbeinu Hanan will skip most of the Shach Matari in the Gemara. If you learn Rabbeinu Hanan consistently, you'll see this is true. The Rabbeinu Hanan skips much of the Sashach Matarya. Now again, not quite as much as the Riv, but not like Rashi. Rashi will comment, running comment on the Shach Matarya and explain the Kohen to get out. The proof was this. Rashi goes through everything. The Rabbeinu Hanan doesn't quite do as much as that. He definitely learned by his father. And some people think he learned by Rav Haigon, but it's not. It's a question if he actually did learn by Rav Haigon, or simply he learned by his father, who learned by Rav Haigon.
His father was one of the four
captains. Rav Haigon Chushia. He lived. That's right. I wrote the years down. Yes. He died around the year 1055. His birth date is not absolutely known. And his death date is also not absolutely known, but around 1055. Sorry about that. Now, I don't know where they got this from, but again, as I said, the person who compiled the Art Scrolls Rishonim is a competent person.
Where is it?
Hirsch Goldman. He's Nifter about 10, 15 years ago. He was not that old. He was mid 60s or so. He was a competent historian. He was really a competent historian. So I'm quoting this. He's a competent historian and a competent Talmud, which is a rarity. So I'm quoting this next thing, which I didn't track. I looked in the Shem of Dome, and he doesn't bring it. And I'm not aware of any other source at the present moment to confirm this, but it's a good story, and I felt it's worth saying over simply to because it does, as we'll see, represent a classic theme occurrence in Jewish history, and that is that Rabbeinu Hanan was really a Rosh Hashiva. However, the merchants of Keroan, the merchants of Tunisia, northern Tunisia, included him as a partner in the business deals and shared profit with him. And as I say, that's a very classic Jewish custom dating back to times of Chumash, and it's traditionally known as Yisachar and Zvulun, and it's a very, very old, ancient Jewish custom. And I'm not sure what the sources for it are, but this specifically happened to Rabbeinu Hanan, but this is something that does happen through the ages. It does happen through the ages. So it happened to Rabbeinu Hanan. Okay, now we're going to go on to Rav Shmuel Hanagid. Rav Shmuel Hanagid lived from 993 to 1055. 993 to 1055.
For sure?
Well, relatively for sure. They didn't have any, relatively for sure. The death date is for sure. Shmuel Hanagid. Shmuel Hanagid is known for two things. One thing is, if you open up Masechtas Brachos, you'll see he wrote something called Mavo HaTalmud, in which he explains the basic general rules of Shas. Mavo HaTalmud. I wouldn't say that would make him unique, because we have plenty of, we saw the Medaktikim wrote dictionaries on Tanakh, and I hope tonight we'll see the Oruch writing a dictionary on Shas. So I don't know if I would call it the creative or foundation stage, but the beginning of the time of the Rishonim, there's been work put into what I call the most basic basics, because if you don't have the most basic basics, then you can't really do much. So general rules are very important.
General rules of Shas.
General rules of Shas. Now, What makes Reb Shmuel Nagid more unique is that he became the chief advisor to the caliph of Spain. There was a Spanish caliphate. In other words, the Muslims conquered Spain. Muslims conquered Spain in around the year 710. We'll talk more about what's called historically Reconquistista, or I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but the reconquest of Spain by the Christians. I'll talk more about that. However, from the year 700 till, I think the year is 11. I don't know if I wrote it down. Till 1103, I think. I'm not sure. Some couple hundred years, Spain was a unified caliphate, which means one man ruled the entire country. One Muslim man ruled basically the entire country. It's definitely true. There were small enclaves of Christian principalities there, but I'm relatively confident, just from general historic knowledge, I highly doubt they weren't paying the caliph tribute yearly. I really highly doubt that. I mean, let me just shift over to explain how things work. When the Crusaders came here in 1100, around 1100, 1096, 1100, conquered Jerusalem in 1098, you can see here, there were, interspersed throughout many more in Lebanon and Syria than in Eretz Yisrael, but there were still small independent Christian rulers. Anyway, they weren't completely independent, of course. But they were small, local, counts, dukes, whatever you want to call them, throughout Lebanon, Syria, and what we call today Eastern Turkey. I mean, Turkey, you understand, before the Turk invasion of the 1200s or so, was not Turkish. It was Greek. They always talk about, yes, but they didn't completely finish off these small little Christian dukedoms, principalities. They did finish them off. They weren't really independent. It's just after the caliphate fell apart, so these people were able to regain power. Anyway, Shmuel Nagid was advisor to one of the caliphs, and that is a very unique Sephardi experience. Sephardi, when I say Sephardi, I mean Spanish, Spain, Jews who originate in Spain. That is definitely in this sense, Sephardi means Spain. That was practically the only place in the late medieval, early modern world, up until the expulsion, the Jews played a major part in the politics. They played a major part. Because why was that true? Because the facts are that, the majority of the people in Spain were Christians. They were being ruled by a Muslim aristocracy. The Muslims did bring in some of their own people, but that was a minority. There were a lot of Jews in Spain. Jews were educated. And the Jews played a major part in Spanish politics from, 1000 until the Spanish expulsion in 1492. A major part. We will see some really interesting historical twists, or I don't know what you want to call them, but as we go through this.
In Europe, wasn't there a concept of having a court Jew?
Court Jews later. The court Jews are much later. The court Jews are
1600.
That's right, about the 1600s. That's when they're starting. Much later.
But it's a similar concept, right?
You know what? You're probably right. I'm not. You're probably right, but I'm not sure. But you're probably right. It's a little different because the political atmosphere in Spain was probably more tolerant than the political atmosphere in Central Europe. And that's where most of the court Jews are, central Europe, more or less.
They're like in England.
I don't think you're right about England. England, I mean, Oliver Cromwell allowed illegally Jews to come back into England. In other words, he didn't enforce the law and allow Jews to come to England in, let's say, around, which should be around 1650, 1651, 1652. Jews were given legal rights in England from 1740.
They were expelled, right?
The Jews were expelled from England in the late 1200s.
Yeah.
They're only readmitted to England as an
Cromwell,
island.
Right?
They're admitted by Cromwell, I told you, in approximately 1651 or maybe 1652, but that wasn't legal. That was, the law was there. It was sort of like when France conquered Western Germany, Alsace-Lorraine, and that area, and the part which used to be part of the Holy Roman Empire, so they inherited Jews. There were Jews living there. And they didn't enforce French law on those Jews. They never did that. Even though Jews only had legal rights in France after the revolution, and it wasn't even 1789, so let's say 1794, it's like I don't quite remember. All these are like well documented facts like this. But there were Jews living in France, and they even allowed Jews to move to Paris. There were Jews living in Paris from at least 1730. At least. So, England, you can't do that. You can't just like, okay, let's just like walk into England. England's an island, and again, knowing English doesn't mean know any other language. So until the Jews were allowed to even illegally come back in by Cromwell in about 1651, they weren't there. I don't think there were court Jews in England. I know English history quite well, and I don't think there were court. They didn't need it. Court Jews were mainly needed by German principalities and of course the Austrians, who had a lot of bureaucracy but no democracy. And they needed someone smart who knew what they were doing to do something. England, because England was relatively speaking free, allowed people of ability to rise, they didn't have the need for it.
Who is the most famous court Jew?
I don't remember offhand. I don't know. Oppenheimer is very famous. Yeah. Dubin Oppenheimer. What was Oppenheimer? That was the guy's name.
Oppenheimer. Yeah.
No. What was it?
What?
Wertheimer. You know Wertheimer. Worthy.
Oh, you mean?
Yeah. He's descended from a court Jew. He's probably one of the only Jewish people up today descended from a court Jew. Now, almost all of them, whatever.
That you were giving us.
Wertheimer, one of Oppenheimer's daughters married a Wertheimer, and he was a very, very well-known, extremely well-to-do Jew in Austria from, this is David Oppenheimer's in the mid-1600s, and this goes all the way up to modern times. Okay, anyway, let's get back on track here. Okay. Bye. Okay, so that's Rav Shmuel Nagid. How he became an advisor. The legend says the following. I didn't track this down. So, but here's what the legend says. The legend says is the caliph had an advisor. Had his his advisor, his main, his prime minister sort of, and his prime minister was dying, and he was very distraught. He's losing his source of advice. The prime minister said, "I'll tell you the truth. Truth is, I got all my advice from my, and I don't know if he was his barber or his, whatever it was, this Jewish guy who used to go visit and tell him all of his problems, and he would give him all the solutions." So the caliph said, "Okay, let's invite this guy in," and that's how he became the advisor to the caliph. He, in traditional terms, supported yeshivas, etc., etc., etc. Okay, now we're going to go on to the riff. The riff is 1013 to 1103. Riff is known as Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. Alfasi means from Fez. That's what Alfasi means. Even though the riff was really born in Algeria, however, he spent the vast majority of his life in Fez. Fez, as we know, is in Morocco. I've met a number of people from Fez. Fez is from Morocco, and he had a yeshiva there for around 50 years.
What year?
He was in Fez from until the year 1075.
When he died?
He died in 1103. He was slandered, which is, again, unfortunately, a typical problem which Jews faced throughout the ages?
1055,
Jews
didn't have? Well, what? Did you say 1055?
No, 1013 to 1103.
No, I'm saying, when did he have...
1075. He had to run away from Fez in 1075. He was a Talmud of the Rach. And I consider this sort of ironic. He had to run away to Spain. He ran away to Spain because of slander and spent the last 18 years of his life there. And that is, in fact, where he had probably the greatest impact.
In Spain.
Even though he was in Morocco for years, decades, I don't know, 50 years, I don't know, is that quite right? But let's say 30 years, 30 or 40 years, he was in Morocco and Fez as, you know, head of the Yeshiva there, where he had the greatest impact was in Spain. Not recorded in any of the sources I know.
Say something on the government or
yeah, probably something like that, you know. Probably something on those lines. The Rimagash, who I'm not going to speak about separately, but I'll just mention now, the Rimagash was his most important Talmud in Spain. And the reason why the Rimagash is so important is because the Rimagash had a Talmud whose name was Maimon. The Rambam...
Really?
The Rambam's father.
Wow.
So
the Rambam's father was the Rimagash.
That's right. The Rambam's father learned by the Rimagash, and the Rimagash learned by the Rif. The Rif died in 1103, and the Rimagash was in his mid-30s when the Rif died. The Rif actually had a son who was a Talmud Chacham, but being a smart Rosh Hashiva, even though he had the rights to make his son Rosh Hashiva, he rather did what was better for the Yeshiva and made the Rimagash the Rosh Hashiva. And again, the Rimagash is very important. Not only Rimagash did write Kiddushim on Bav Basra, which some of us may be familiar with or have heard of at least.
Some of us like the Rosh Hashiva?
It wasn't then. No one mentioned it last year, the Rimagash. Now, just for the facts, I'll probably get into this later. It's like there's certain cute legends which are not true, and the facts are is the Rambam was 6 when the Rimagash died, so it is definitely possible that the Rambam personally met the Rimagash, but it is basically impossible to say that the Rambam learned by the Rimagash. Okay, the Rif, besides being a teacher at Rosh Hashiva, the most important thing he did was write Halachas HaRif. Let's see, this one has it right here. Here we go, right here. This does not have it, but... Well, this does have it. Here we go. Hilchos Rav Alvas. Here we have it.
There's a Gemara here that doesn't have the Rif.
There are Gemaras without the Rif. Can you believe there are Gemaras without the Rif? Yes, there are Gemaras without the Rif.
No, I'm saying, like, isn't that, like, nowadays not...
No, there are some people, you know, like, I don't know, let's see.
That one's a really
learned by Rabbeinu
Hananel. The Rif learned by Rabbeinu Hananel, yes.
Rabbeinu Hananel was Ashkenaz.
No, Rabbeinu Hananel was Cairo and Tunisia. And from Morocco, Tunisia are absolutely... And the Rif himself was born in Algeria, which is Algeria, if you know, I hope you know your North African geography, Algeria is practically next door to Tunisia. But all the Mediterranean is basically in contact with each other. Again, as the only thing which would you know, southern France was slightly disrupted because of the Muslim-Christian issues. But no. There is even theory if Rabbeinu Gershom worked by the Rach or not, and that's possible. It's all possible, but it's very hard to prove one way or the other. Okay, what the Rif is most important and most known for is the Halachas, and it's the first. It's not the first again. It's not Amish the first. There are earlier Halachic, you know, codifications of Halacha. But what the Rif did, is A, he was more comprehensive than anyone before him. He's more comprehensive, and more than that, he like And you know, to us, we don't see it so much. And I've done a nice amount of learning, so I'm talking now from personal experience. But he set in action, or you know, he like started patterning in looking at suyas. If you understand what I mean. In other words, what do I mean by that? When we look at a sugya, there is certain structure to the sugya. You say, I have whiteboard. I have this Gemara says this, that Gemara says that. What do I do about that? How do I reconcile the two Gemaras? The riff starts at the riff is a posek, it's not a mafarish. But psak and perush are intimately touching each other, and psak and perush absolutely heavily influences psak. Perush and psak are so intertwined. I would practically say you cannot separate
them. It's a perush now. Don't you mean there's a perush?
The riff.
Yeah.
Let's go on another step or two. Part of the importance of the riff is the Rambam, I would say, always paskens like the riff, but usually paskens like the riff. So it's a mistake simply to say that the riff's. Some people mistakenly say that the riff's influence is how much he influenced the Rambam, and that's not really true. If you learned sugyas at lahalacha consistently, you will see that everyone, even though the Rambam and the riff usually go together, that doesn't mean that there doesn't give more weight to that sad, to that issue in halacha. Having the Rambam and the Riff saying it gives extra weight. It's not just we say, oh well, the Rambam was just going with the Riff, and we don't do that. The Riff and the Rambam at the end of the day is an independent thinker, a very independent thinker, and it's true that he followed the Riff. I mean, it's interesting. The Hakdamat Parsha Mishnah, he says, I'm not sure if I'm getting this quote right, but as I recall, he says there's maybe 10 to 12 places where the Riff was wrong. In Mishnah Torah, he contests some more than that. And he wrote Mishnah Torah later. For he compiled the Parsha and Mishnah between the ages of 18 and 30, and Mishnah Torah he did a little bit later. So when he got down to actually paskening, he paskened less like
the Riff. Well, the Riff paskens that we don't paskin like Yerushalmi, the Rambam argues on that.
That's like a phenomenon that people have noted, that the Rambam does appear to paskin Yerushalmi many times over Bavli, but it's not like something which, you know.
The Rif says we don't paskin like Yerushalmi at all.
That is not true. The Rif quotes Yerushalmi, I would say, a significant amount of times. Tosus quotes the Rambam once in Shas. Okay, I believe it's somewhere in Zvachim, but maybe it's not. Tosus quotes the Rambam once in Shas. Rashi quotes the Aruch once in Shas. Okay, the Rif does not quote the Yerushalmi once or twice. It's true.
Wait a second.
It's true that the Riff doesn't consistently bring the Yerushalmi. That is true. But the Riff does bring Yerushalmi enough.
The Riff says we pass with the Basra, though.
The general klal of what we call poskim is that you go with the Babli over the Yerushalmi. That is the general klal.
It's brought down by the Riff. Well, you learned this in Shia. It's brought down by the Riff.
Okay.
So. If the Riff says we pass like the Basra, how can you tell me that he passes like Yerushalmi over the Babli?
You know what they say? Every rule has exceptions except for this one.
Nice. It's very deep.
And it's you're basically right. You're basically right, and there is a feeling amongst Ramdanim out there that the Rambam will paskin the Yerushalmi over the Bavli, and the Riff says he doesn't, and I'm not saying he never does, but he very rarely does. I'm not sure if it's that much. There are people who to ask questions like this. I mean, I'm aware of it as having learnt enough l'halacha to be aware of what's out there. But you have to ask someone like Rav Tzvi Cheshen or Ramesh Shmulevitz a question like this. Those are the type of people who would be able to answer something like this.
How could Tosfos quote the Rambam?
Historically not problematic at all. Because Tosfos were compiled, we're going to get to Tosfos and let's say, we'll do Rashi, then I think we'll do the Rambam first, then we'll go back to Tosfos. And the later Bali Tosfos, the middle late era of Tosfos, and they were absolutely aware of the Rambam. It's an interesting question why he's not quoted more. The Rif is quoted by Tosfos, not that much, but the Rif is quoted. There's no question that Tosfos was aware of the Rif. There's no question. It doesn't mean, and there's no question that Tosfos respected the Rif as as an authority and a scholar. But Tosfos doesn't refer to the Rif that much. He just doesn't. That's just a fact. He just doesn't. But again, the Rif started. He's like the beginning in terms of structure of halachic analysis of sugyas. He's in the open, much more than his predecessors. And this sugya says that sugya says that. What are we going to do? I mean, I would say that's like sort of one step towards Tosfos, but I'm not sure if I want to say it that way. Now, we can also see, as you're probably aware, people aren't always really aware of this, but here we have the Rif here in the back. One way to gauge the Rif's deep influence is how many Perushim were written on the Rif. And the Ran here is basically written on the Rif. It is true that the Ran, definitely more than Mugi Yosef, for example, will go back and bring Gemaras that the Rif decided not to talk about. That is true. But the Ran, in the back of the Gemaras, is really a parish on the Rif.
When did the Ran move?
The Ran's the last of the Rishon. He's going to take a little while. My present, I mapped out things a little bit. I really hope we'll get to 1700. He's 13. The Ran's 1310 to 1385.
You're saying in general?
I hope this year we'll get to around 1700. The reason why I don't know if we'll get much past that is because it's such a complicated difficulty and hyper controversial. And all modern Jewish history is dependent on Shabbat.
Really?
Absolutely. No one doubts that. So we'll see. Let's go on. Okay, so there's of course the Balmor and the Ramban. There's the Ran. There's Talmidei Rabbeinu Yonah, which is in a couple of places. Brachas Kulin in a couple of other places. Erevin, the Mukhei Yosef, and there are others also. That just shows you,
the
Mukhei Yosef is a parish on the Rif. Okay, let's go on now to the Aruch. The Aruch is written by Rav Nosson, 1035 to 1102. The Aruch, it's a big question who the Aruch learned by, and it was Lila as a question. The Aruch is very important. He was from Rome. He was very important because he wrote the first dictionary of Shas. And, as they say, the definition of a word is absolutely critical. As Yerushalmi Fundamai says, I used to think it's a joke, but you never know today. So you can know the entire Masechta of Erevin, but if you don't know the difference between it, I'll show you two different abbreviations. See those two abbreviations? What's that one stand for? Resh, hey, Resh. Anyone know? Rishus Harabim.
Oh.
Do you know what this one stands for?
Rishus
Harabim. If you don't know how to translate the difference between this one and this one, you can know every single word in Arabic. And you can know everything the Rashi and Tosfos say, all the Rishonim and Rambam with all the mumbles, but you don't understand the Sakta at all.
No, you will understand the Masechta, just the opposite of everything.
Yeah, you'll just have everything wrong, It's like in Baba Kama, if you don't know which guy's the mazik, which guy's the nizik, then you're out in left field. These are like radical cases, but I'm just, you know, just from the radical cases, we can understand the more simple cases. The Aruch is very important. You want to take the dictionary in Shas. That's also like a general work, similar again. He like plays the part, but not nearly as central in Shas. As a Balik Dikta, because you know Rabbeinu Dunash and Rabbeinu Menachem play in Tanakh, I would say it's not nearly as central, but it's definitely important. Again, Rashi quotes him once. Tosfos quotes him a lot more, specifically when he wants to argue with Rashi, because the Aruch is Arishan, then he's not his opinions about what. What a word means have real weight, and will definitely have halachic substance when applicable. Okay, I'm going to start up. I didn't really think I'd get this far. Wow. Okay, we're going to go back now and start talking about Rashi. There's no way we're going to get through all of Rashi today, so I'm going to maybe even stop a minute or two early. Rav Nosson ben Yechiel. He was in Italy. Now we're going to go back to where we go over to Rashi. Rashi lived in northeastern France. He learned by Yehuda ben Yakar. I gave you the dates of Rashi. 1040 to 1105. That's the dates. You know, like certain people's dates you're really supposed to remember. And Rashi's one of them. Rashi's just like so good of them. It's not Rashi, but it's Rashi. Right? Rashi's 1040 to 1105.
So he's like same time as the Rif.
He's a little, you know what? He is and he's not. Because he died around the same time, but he's really a generation afterwards. He's a generation afterwards. The Rif learned by the Rav.
That's what made the Rif so good, is because there wasn't really comprehensive. Right, is that true?
There were other people, but they didn't. There's the Ritz Ibn Gaius. I was trying to talk about Emma Risha, we wouldn't get anywhere. So there were other people, but they weren't as systematic and not as. They just didn't have the historical impact that the Ritz did. The Ritz has major, major historical impact in a way that the others didn't. Rashi learned by Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar, Rabbi Yitzchak Kalevi, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yehuda. They were all Talmidim of Rabbeinu Gershom Mor HaGadol.
He was in France right now.
Rabbeinu Gershom Mor HaGadol's yeshiva was in Mainz. Mainz is Western Germany, but see, in this period of time, that was all in the Western and more civilized part of the Holy Roman Empire. Because Rashi did live
northeastern France.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, because the borders in those days weren't like borders today. You didn't need passports. So passports were invented. I'm pretty sure the British invented passports. British and French invented passports in the early 1700s. So you need passports. France was quite feudal at that time. And you can
like Rabbeinu Gershom's yeshiva is still going on.
Yes, Rabbeinu Gershom's yeshiva.
He went
to Rabbeinu Gershom's yeshiva, who was no longer headed by Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom died 1040 when Rashi Bratton was born. But the Talmidei Rabbeinu Gershom, Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar, Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi, and Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yehuda, who Rashi quotes, I wouldn't say regularly because that's not accurate, but he quotes them a solid amount of times in Shas. And you're not like talking like 5, 10, or 20. We're talking about a nice amount of times in Shas. A nice amount of times in Shas. Now, I'm like always overwhelmed by Rashi. And, you know, the first thing that's overwhelming is Rashi was a wine merchant. That's what Rashi was. Rashi was not a full-time rabbinics. And actually, you know, I'll tell you just, you know, like, I don't know, tongue-in-cheek, or you know, maybe more, you know, reflective. If you think that rabbis can spend all the day learning, you've got something coming to you. Rabbis, definitely communal rabbis, have real obligations in their communities.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, it could be Rashi's a wine merchant, was able to have a lot more extra time than if he would have been a rabbi.
Wasn't he a communal rabbi though?
No, he was not. Rashi was not. He was a respected authority. He wrote, we have 360 of his responsa, of his shas and shuvas, of questions, you know, halachic inquiries given to Rashi. He was absolutely respected as a halachic authority, but he was not, did not head a yeshiva, and also was not you know, a practicing rabbi.
Why aren't his responses like as famous halachic works as?
Why are his responses not as famous? Because we only have 360 of them.
No, I'm saying
they are going to be.
You never even.
No, because
look at them.
That's not. It's like this. A large amount of Rashi's responsa, Shas and Jews were like lost.
Yeah, right.
For hundreds of years, and refound. So they're. It's not that they're not. They are permanent, and they are important. But because they weren't part of the body of, you know, the halakhic process, so they're just not as referred to as Rashi's Beres and Shas.
Similar to Tamiri.
It's sort of similar. Now, I'm not sure. In other words, it's hard. You also have to realize that 360 Shas and Shuvas is not much at all.
Yeah,
it's not much. You know how many of the Rashi wrote that we have?
Frankly, no. I imagine it's a lot.
The Rashi wrote, we have 3,000 Shuvas from the Rashi.
That's a lot.
Okay? That's a lot of Shuvas. Okay? From the Rabbaz, we have 2,500 shuvas.
And a half?
2,500 shuvas.
Oh, I thought you meant 2,000
and a half then.
How much money?
Okay, so Rashi wrote 360. I don't know how many of them were known. Okay, let's say a third of them were known. So that's not that significant. And things which are dependent, any tshuva dependent on minig. In other words, tefillah, hilchas tefillah. And a lot of Orach Chaim is dependent on, it's not only the sugyas. A lot of times in terms of the sugyas, you can go one way or the other, and what's most important is what was nikva, what the later Rishonim decided, and because of that, things like this, which Rashi commented on, okay, again, it has weight, it means something, but it's just not going to be as central. Okay, I want to stop here. Okay, we're going to talk next week more about Rashi's Perish, and I have a lot to say about Rashi's Perish.